This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Goldwalk Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice.
I would like to welcome our guest to the Gold Rock podcast, Definitely Uncertain. Our guest today is Saul Singer. He is a writer, an author. He's been in Israel for well over 30 years. He's the co-author of the super successful Startup Nation. He dedicated Startup Nation to his brother, Alex Singer, if I'm right, who fell in battle in the IDF. And I think another detail that maybe not everybody knows, that I think he and Alex both spent some time in the Otef, in the in Kibbutz Kisufim. So for hundreds of other reasons, but also some pretty personal reasons, Saul can probably give an amazing perspective to where we are right now. And actually, Saul and I sat about a year and a half ago. I was checking in the calendar, and he was kindly asked to sit and chat and about where we're at in Israel. And I don't think either of us could possibly have imagined a year and a half later where we would be in terms of Israel and Israeli society. So it's a special privilege for us to have Saul on. So welcome, Saul. Thanks for coming.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And I think maybe the first place I would want to start from is, having written Startup Nation, and obviously that was a number of years ago, in the early 2000s. What was the spark? What was the motivator, or the thing that, you know, let's do this again and look at it from a different angle?
Well, Dan Senor and I, Dan is based in New York, I'm based in Jerusalem. We had noticed, particularly Dan, because he was looking from outside, how amazing the startup ecosystem in Israel was. And he actually was here in Israel with the first group of Harvard Business School students coming to Israel. And they were amazed at what they were seeing, and they wanted to know more, and he wanted to give them a book. So we looked around to see if anyone had written a book, and no one had, so we decided to write it. Wow. That's how it started.
And how long were you guys working on the research for the book before, you know, putting pen to paper, as it were?
Well, it took a couple of years at least. We did hundreds of interviews. The way we write is we, you know, interview people and tell stories to illustrate what we're trying to say. And that's what we did with Startup Nation, and also now with our new book, The Genius of Israel, that just came out.
Okay. And thinking about the book itself, The Genius of Israel, it is all about the resilience of this country. And, you know, you think about countries who go through the types of crises that we've seen, like the Blitz and, you know, the siege of Moscow and the siege of Leningrad in the Second World War, and, you know, many, many other examples. When you now look at Israel's response versus those other things, what is it that explains this kind of bottom-up surge of solidarity and resilience? What are the things that I think people looking from the outside don't understand that you can show through the book?
Well, this was actually the big challenge of writing this book, was to try to explain to Israeli society and kind of the softer parts, things like solidarity and belonging and sense of purpose, that is hard to describe to someone who's never been here. But it's really palpable, I think, for those of us who have moved here from other places, or for Israelis who have spent time living in other countries. They get it immediately. There's a very big contrast. And but what surprised us is that it's reflected in objective statistics, objective facts about Israel and the health of Israeli society. You can see this solidarity play out really in the sort of mental health of the society. For instance, if some people know about the UN World Happiness Report, mm-hmm. and are somewhat amused to find out that Israel is not number 50 or number 25 in the world, but number 4, along with the Nordic states, or kind of dominate the top 10, presumably happiest countries. And, we were skeptical, I think, like many people might be, like Israelis are, given that how much they complain about their country, and don't, always walk around with a smile on their face. So we started checking, and the best way to kind of check more objectively, and this we sort of got from Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winner economist, who basically says you should measure the happiness of society based on the lack of suffering rather than the high end. And so we looked at something called deaths of despair, which a lot of countries are just struggling with. It's a phrase coined in the United States referring to deaths from suicide and substance abuse, basically. You know, the opioid epidemic and all that. And according to the OECD statistics, Israel has the lowest of these types of deaths by far in the OECD among rich countries.
Did you manage to look at that sort of statistics over time, like going backwards as well?
Yes. Well, it's been increasing. It's been increasing throughout the West, basically. And you look at something like teen suicide, something particularly tragic, and Israel again has the lowest in the OECD, dramatically lower than the average, dramatically lower even than the Nordic countries that are high on the happiness list. And then you just keep going, and there are other key metrics, like the rich countries of the world today are facing demographic collapse.
Right.
All of these countries have dropped below the replacement level, which is 2.1 a long time ago. The average is 1.6 fertility rate of children per woman. And that simply, there's a simple effect of that, which is when your country drops below that rate of 2.1, you start aging and shrinking. And so Israel...
I think not many people realize that. I think they would associate that normally with kind of the more religious end of Israeli society. But what the book tells the story is this is something which is in many ways across the board. Everybody seems to be having more kids here than almost all other, and maybe all other developed nations, right? It's not just something about the religious community.
Yes, it's all other rich countries by far, where our rate here is about 3 children per woman, so about double the average. And it's right that a lot of people think that's because of the ultra-Orthodox, and it's just not true, because though they do have a very high birth rate, if you look around Tel Aviv, the typical number of children that you see is 3. 3 is kind of a normal number. 2 is a little bit on the small side. 4 is on the big side. But 3 is very normal number of kids here in Israel, even among secular Israelis.
And when you were interviewing people from Tel Aviv or the secular parts of Israeli society, did you ask them about what it is that's driving them to have bigger families, many of whom will have either experience of or seen, how the high-tech world lives in New York or London or San Francisco, whatever? Could you sort of get a qualitative response to that? Is that something that, that people talk about?
Well, Israel is very family oriented, and this is something that strikes everybody who comes here. And it's kind of a positive feedback loop, because the larger the families are, the more kids are everywhere, and the more the country kind of by necessity becomes more family friendly. And being family friendly makes it easier to have kids. So it's like a positive feedback loop. If you look at why rich countries start having lower fertility rates, I think a key factor, and you see this in the countries that have the lowest rates, like Korea and Japan, Singapore, in countries where women feel that they have to make a very stark choice between children and career, the fertility rates are particularly low. And I think that's happened kind of across Western societies. And also, as the value of individualism continues to rise and is not balanced by anything else. Having kids is hard. It's not.
Tell me about it.
if you want to, you know, perfect self-actualization as an individual, you might not want to have kids. So Israeli women, I think in particular, again, this is something that sticks out, is that, you know, young families start having kids in their 20s, and they don't let that stop them from studying, from starting their careers. It's just considered, you know, you do both. That's kind of the normal way of things. It's not you do one and then the other. So that is an aspect of family friendliness that really helps promote family. Another is that grandparents are very involved in helping raise the kids. And lastly, the Israel and the Jewish people generally, I would say, are not just individually focused. We're very focused on community as well. Mm-hmm. That's true throughout Jewish history, but it's especially true in Israel, where we have a whole chapter in the book about something in Hebrew called Gipush, which means kind of the process of bringing people together. And Israelis love to do it. And they start, you know, trying to bring people together from early on in childhood, in school, in youth movements, in gap year programs. And the epitome of it is in the military, where you have to build a cohesive unit in order to function as a military. So this value of the group, of society, of your country, of things that are larger than you, is pervasive in Israel. And again, I think has this feedback loop with larger families and stronger families.
You're really talking about, I think, what they, in sort of either political or social terms, they talk, it's social capital. It's the building of kind of the bottom up asset of society, which is built around this idea of I'm not just an I, but I am a we. And I think also when you talk about the Gibush idea, I've never really thought about it this way, but again, in the terms described theoretically, we think of it as bonding and bridging between either, you know, between people who identify with one another, or indeed those that don't agree with me, because we have this common, you know, common goal or common need to do so. It's almost like you're saying, because we are in this kind of unique position in the Middle East, and we can't rely on natural resources, and we've got, you know, we're surrounded by enemies or whatever, that almost drives the need for us to get across the barrier of the individual. And, you know, without the we can't actually deal with those outside things. Is it one feeding the other? Is it because we have the solidarity, we can deal with the outside threat? Or is the outside threat that's actually keeping us together?
So again, I think this is another one of those positive feedback loops, because we do need to be together to survive. And the fact that we are surrounded by enemies and have a sort of chronic security threat means that we have this feeling that we're all in the same boat. That, you know, whatever differences there are between us, we share something very important. Of course, Jews feel that way about the Jewish people, but also as Israelis, we feel like we share something. And I think this is what we've seen in spades, of course, since the war started. And you asked about the incredible ability we've seen to come together and to help each other and to participate. You've had, you know, over 100% participation in the reserve call-up rate here, 120%. Normally, they expect 80% to show up when they call up the reserves. And people were banging on the doors to get in. People who had, you know, aged out of the reserve service or were traveling, you know, they packed the airplanes coming back to Israel. But that's just the soldiers. Everybody left behind, you know, came together to help the soldiers, to help each other, to, you know, keep the companies going, to help all the people who were evacuated and the families of the hostages and the wounded and the killed. You know, the bringing together, the consolidation of society that we've seen has been absolutely incredible and not something that I think you could see anywhere else. It's not just a kind of a amorphous feeling of solidarity, like say after 9/11 or something. It's something much more practical of everybody feeling like they've been drafted to the fight, whether on the home front or physically in the military.
Right, more Battle of Britain than 9/11 in that sense.
Yes,
that's super interesting. Having looked at the position that we are currently in, and obviously, funnily enough, I'm wondering whether Genius of Israel shouldn't be translated into Hebrew, because sometimes I think we need to persuade ourselves the position that we are in from that kind of, you know, deep-seated infrastructure of solidarity. But obviously, a lot of talk in the media here and you know, around Friday night tables is about what will happen here when the fighting stops and when we have to make, you know, a further round of difficult decisions as a country going forward. Are there things that you would like us to think about or highlight that can help us to get through the next phase? Right now, we do feel this kind of existential threat, and therefore that's brought almost everybody together. As soon as that, you know, almost as we, whatever victory looks like, as soon as we defeat Hamas, one wonders what it's going to look like afterwards. What would you be, you know, if I were in the government, what would you be telling me, right?
So we have contradictory forces at play here. On the one hand, there's this kind of mantra, Yachad Ninatzeach, together we will win. There's this instinctive feeling that we have to stay together. The more threatened we are, we have to. And the more we do pull together. And there's, I think, an overwhelming feeling here that we must find a way to stay together going forward, because right before this war broke out, as we know, there were very bitter protests over the judicial overhaul, you know, hundreds of thousands of people coming out in the streets, and it was getting kind of more and more extreme over time, and was only stopped by the war itself. And, you know, so the grievances or disagreements that, you know, were behind that haven't gone away, will come back to some degree or another when the war is over. And so there is a contest here between that desire to stay together and the real issues we have in society that we need to resolve. And, you know, which wins out is, I think, incredibly important for the future of this country. And it is a reason why I really do believe it should come out in Hebrew, and actually will probably in the summertime, there's a big article on the cover of Haaretz magazine in Hebrew that I was happy to see, you know, that telling people about the book, because I think it really is important that Israelis read it, because if we are to stay together, we have to build on our own strengths. And to do that, we have to understand where they come from and what they are. We can't just assume, we can't take them for granted. We have to understand how different this place is from other places, that we have this kind of power that we need to build on and not destroy. And I actually believe it is a model for other countries, because the kind of, you know, despair and sense of decline and, you know, loneliness and all kinds of mental problems you have in these other places, Israel has less of that. And we know.
Have you had people from other countries either invite you or already interview saying, a little bit like what happened with Startup Nation, where, like, you know, Startup Nation started as an exclusively Israeli branding, and then lots of countries wanted to be Startup Nation, replicate it, you know, do it their own way. Have you already seen any sense of that? People saying, "Wow, you must have, you know, there is something going on. Can we bottle it? Is there a way of like making policy around it?" Have you had that conversation yet?
Well, like Startup Nation, we're getting requests for by publishers in many countries to translate it in China and Korea and Spain and you know, Vietnam and many other countries are popping up, and I have been getting some speaking requests internationally. I do think, I hope that there will be the kind of fascination with what Israel has done here, because, you know, as interesting as startups are and how much every country wants to be innovative, a more central challenge for society is how do we become richer and more modern without becoming overly individualistic and our societies kind of falling apart?
Yeah.
The crisis of meaning and the crisis of loneliness and these crises of modernity, there's no solution out there. It's just getting worse. And I think Israel has elements of a solution here. And so I do hope that other countries see this as a possible model.
Yeah. What is fascinating, you know, most people look at the, you know, crisis in the Western world and the, you know, the crisis around democracy is either culture wars or identity wars. It could be that, you know, reading the book, you see actually the exit from that is not really purely a political issue, but is looking at different, you know, different set of parameters or issues altogether. I think that's something which, almost on its own, as we sit at this moment, not just in Israel, but, you know, across so many countries where there is this kind of tension going on, looking at it from a different angle, and maybe this is something that Israel has to offer. Maybe one last question for this time, although I feel like we could do this for literally for hours. Obviously, Startup Nation had a very economic aspect to it, and you know, obviously the high tech and innovation part of the economy has been a huge engine for economic success. Do you look at the genius of Israel and think that also has economic implications? Meaning those same characteristics that you talk about, which are, you know, the we versus the I, and the family orientation, and the, you know, the ability to do stuff together in the face of adversity, does that have an easy translation also into our economic well-being? No doubt, you know, after we're one day after the Moody's report and so forth, we're going to need a lot of solidarity around economic issues. Do you see in the data that you have in the book something which leads to economic conclusions as well?
Absolutely. I think there are huge economic implications at the macro level and the sort of innovation level. On the macro level, young and growing societies, which Israel is the only one among the wealthy countries, are going to have more economic energy than countries that are basically winding down, where the average age is going up into the 50s. And, you know, it's a society that isn't basically thinking that much about the future. Here, you know, people are making, you know, having children in a way is the biggest bet on the future. And here people are betting on the future. There is data that Israelis are more optimistic than these other countries, particularly about the financial situation of their children. That in Israel is one of the few Western countries that where people believe that their children will be better off financially than they were. That's one. Another, though, is innovation. There are actually studies that show that a young person is more likely to be innovative in a younger society than an older society, the same young person, for different reasons. But also, we just have more young people. Innovation tends to be a younger person's game. And also, I would say, you know, I've interviewed people in the high-tech sector here after the war started. And I feel there's a determination there to do more, both in their startups, but also for Israeli society. They feel like they weren't involved enough before, and now they have to. And they're even more driven to do something for their country. Partly, they see what they can do for their country is being startup nation. And that is true. It is the driver of the economy. That is something. But now they think they also need to be part of Israeli society more, not just kind of citizens of the world doing their exits and their markets outside of Israel.
So you have given me a whole bunch of reasons to be optimistic, which in the current environment is an incredibly important mission. I hope everybody who listens or watches this will rush out and get a copy of the book, because I think it's a kind of therapy to think about the powers that we have within us and as a society in order to get through the next phase. As I said at the beginning, it's a great honor and a privilege to have had you on. I would love to have you back, maybe see how the book goes, and maybe when it comes out in Hebrew, we'll see how it's received also in Israel. And I just want to say thank you, and good luck with the book and taking the message out.
My pleasure. Great to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, my pleasure.